Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of September 18th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few things. We'll talk about the extension of Harvey hurricane relief to the victims of Hurricane Irma. We'll also take a look at two states that had different approaches to getting around the quill limitations. And we'll find our first case this week that deals with portability, and specifically what the IRS can do when the second spouse dies about going back and looking at the first spouse's return. We are coming up on due dates, and we just passed the one for our partnerships here on September 15th. We're now rapidly heading toward the one for trusts and estates on the 30th, and then going on to individuals on the 15th of October. But we do have a few courses in all of that. Wanted to remind you that we have coming up in New York City, as we mentioned the last couple of weeks, and online, a session on the 28th for current federal tax developments. Also on the 29th, real estate partnerships, both of those led by Don Cochran. It will be in Manhattan on Wall Street, but if you can't be there, and you know, many of us can't be there, the New York Society is also offering this as a webcast, and signups for that are at their website at cpe.nysscpa.org. I'm going to be heading on the 28th to Fairfield, Ohio. We're going to talk about multi-state taxation of businesses, which is actually pretty important at this point because, as we've discussed, we've got a bunch of state developments going on, especially in the area of sales and use taxes and businesses having to collect that. That's part of what we talk about there. We talk about the nexus in all of its various forms, along with other issues coming up with multi-state taxation of businesses. So if you want to come there in Fairfield, Ohio, that'll be put on by the Ohio Society of CPAs. It is live only, so you have to sign up and get to Fairfield. You can sign up at www.ohiocpa.com. And then finally, coming up, before we get to the October 15th date, Don Cochran will be doing 2 days in Rapid City, South Dakota. On October 4th, he'll be looking at assisting the survivors of a decedent's estate. And as part of that course, there'll be coverage of the South Dakota Uniform Principal and Income Act. He'll also take a look at October 5th on the same thing I'll be doing in Cincinnati, which is going to be looking at multi-state taxation of businesses. Now, Don's going to be essentially at the location where one of the big developments took place that we're going to talk about this week, that is in South Dakota. So if you want to sign up for those, again, those are live only, not broadcast. You can sign up at sdcpa.org and make your way to Rapid City on those days to attend those courses. Now coming up, let's take a look at what's actually happening this week in the developments. The first thing I wanted to cover with you is to just briefly go over all of the hurricane relief that's now been expanded to cover victims of Hurricane Irma. It's possible some of you who now have clients impacted by Irma, you know, were listening to Harvey but not real close and may have kind of missed out on what relief provisions were given to Harvey victims, because those have been, as not unexpectedly, now expanded to cover victims of Hurricane Irma. First, the IRS and Notice 2017-52 that was issued on September the 14th. They expanded the option for employer-sponsored leave-based donation programs to cover Irma victims as well, those who are in, you know, for relief for Irma. Now, this actually can be anywhere in the country, and your program, though, can just allow employees to donate their leave, you know, their leave of any sort, to the employer, who then turns around and makes a donation based on the value of that leave to hurricane relief for the victims of Irma or the victims of Harvey. When we do that, what this ruling tells us, and you want to check this if you're going to be setting up such a program, go check the actual notice, or at least the relevant one. If you're looking for Harvey, go get the Harvey notice. This is the Irma notice. They really are virtually the same. You do have to make sure, you know, the good news is if you do this right, it is not considered income to the employee, so we don't have that situation where it's income and they have to itemize to get a charitable deduction that's going to bump, that would bump their AGI, which is not a good choice normally. It's also considered to be compensation on the employer's return, not a charitable contribution. Obviously, you know, charitable contributions generally for most business entities are far less favorably treated than our standard compensation style deductions. So that's good news. Again, check that. The amounts have to be sent to the charities that are going to, you know, be helping with Irma and Harvey relief by January of 2019. So there's some time to get the money over. But those programs, you're going to set one up, be sure to check the notice. They also extended the special rule for retirement plan loans and hardship distributions. You can, if your plan is an eligible plan to have hardship distributions, or most plans, you'd be eligible to make retirement loans subject to certain restrictions, you effectively have a much easier way of doing that. First, you don't need to get your plan amended for a little while to authorize this. You can just start doing it. And secondly, on hardship distributions, it'll be considered a fine, okay reason for a hardship distribution if an employee says, I've been damaged by Irma, or I've been damaged by Irma is this week's deal, and I need money. You know, I need money to help me recover from Irma. Unless the employer knows that statement is false, the employer can use that to justify a hardship distribution. Please remember, not all retirement plans are allowed to have hardship distribution provisions. So you have to have a plan that would allow for it, generally a profit-sharing plan, not a pension plan. And then you're still going to have to get the language in there to allow for hardship distributions. But again, if you're thinking of doing that, please go check announcement 2017-13. That was issued on September 12th. Finally, the IRS in news release 2017-150, also on September 12th, again, pushed back the due dates and tax deposit dates. That particular issue, now again, for all of the items due, for any taxpayers that live in the affected counties, and those are the counties that have been declared disaster areas, generally for Irma, it's in Florida, but some spilled over into neighboring states. So if you're on, you know, if you're in a neighboring state, like some counties in Georgia were impacted by this, you can still get this relief. It says any return that is due from the date that the disaster declaration starts until January 31st of 2018, you don't have to file that document until January 31st of 2018. So that would include the October 15th individual income tax returns on extension. It would include those partnership returns, because again, the disaster declaration started before September 15th, last Friday, and it will include these trusts. Now, the IRS does warn, it doesn't mean you won't pay interest, because remember, the tax was due back in April. There wasn't a disaster declaration in April. So if you're short on the tax, the interest will continue to run, as will the failure to pay penalty, because that goes back to an action that should have been taken in April of this year. So it still might be worth it to try to get these things filed as quickly as possible, but the actual failure to file problem will not come up till January 31st. Also, there is a much shorter period of time where you're allowed to make payroll tax deposits that were due, as of the date this started, right up until basically as of the date this started for a little time frame afterwards, generally you're allowed 15 days after the date the disaster declaration starts. You have a payroll tax deposit that was due on or after that date. As long as it's made by the 15th day after the declaration started, that'll be a timely payroll tax deposit. The IRS, as with Harvey, claims that they will automatically grant this relief if your client has has their address in an affected county. If you have somebody who's impacted by it, but they don't live in the affected counties, because let's say their books and records are being held by their CPA who is in the affected county, but they may be outside the affected county, then you're gonna have to contact the IRS for relief. But again, if these things apply to you, make sure you go back and check the detailed notices. Again, all of these are found in the weekly update document that you can download from the weekly, updates video and audio page on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Get it for this week. Again, notice 2752 for the leave-based donations programs, announcements 2017-13 for the retirement plan loans, and News Relief 2017-150 for the due date pushback for those affected by Hurricane Irma. Well, in addition to that, we've had a few other developments this week. And the big things that happened this week was we had two different cases where states are going after the Quill decision. And in one case, we have a state taking on Quill head on. And in the other case, we have a state trying to render Quill so inert as to be, we don't care if it's overturned or not. Let's take a look at the head-on challenge first. Now, for those who don't remember, and this particular case is going to involve the state of South Dakota, and the actual case is the state of South Dakota versus Wayfair. This is an opinion issued this week by the South Dakota Supreme Court, case number 28160, and the opinion was issued on September 14th of 2017. Now, those who don't remember the Quill case, and this goes back quite a ways, but we had the Quill case. It was the state of North Dakota versus Quill, the office supply outfit, and the state of North Dakota attempted to require Quill to collect, not really sales tax, they were going for use tax, but as we all know, that's kind of the same difference. And they claimed that, you know, they basically said, we should have a right to do it because they're obviously selling into the state of North Dakota. And they even tried to, understanding that the Bella Hess rule would require some sort of physical presence, they argued first that that should be outdated, but number two, if it wasn't, they argued that, well, okay, they're sending catalogs into North Dakota, and people throw those catalogs away, so they're going to landfills, so they're really making use of North Dakota resources, so we should, of course, be able to tax them. The Supreme Court, in the Quill decision, came down and said, well, you know, they kind of decided that, well, if we were starting from scratch, it's very likely we would agree with you, North Dakota. But we're not starting from scratch. Rather, there's been a long history of case law going through the Bella Hess case that effectively laid down that a state could not require an out-of-state seller to collect and pay sales tax unless they had a physical presence in the state in question. Now, they did knock away some of the underpinnings of Bella Hess, and they even suggested that, you know, we're only doing this because of that history, and, you know, maybe things are going to change, and that will no longer be relevant some point in the future. But they did accept that. Last year, you may recall, we discussed earlier this year, we discussed the case of Direct Marketing Association versus Brohl, like we discussed last year, brought up a couple of times. That was a case where the state of Colorado enacted a provision that said, well, if you sell into Colorado, you need to give us a list of the customers, and you've got to tell the customers they owe you tax and send them a notice about how much they bought at the end of the year, all those things. As that case was being tried, initially the federal courts tried to say, well, we can't rule on that. You know, we're barred by ruling on that. We don't have jurisdiction. That particular issue went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, who did rule on that issue. And the Supreme Court said, yes, you have authority. But what was interesting was that Justice Kennedy, in a concurrence to that opinion, effectively said that we really need to consider, you know, looking over and maybe overturning that the Quill decision, stating that in the view of the dramatic technological and social changes that have taken place in our increasingly interconnected economy, maybe it's time to take a look at this. Now, Justice Kennedy went on to say that the Direct Marketing versus Brohl case wasn't really the case to decide this based on. And the 10th Circuit also ruled that Quill didn't apply. In essence, Colorado wasn't implicating Quill at all, at least in the view of the 10th Circuit, which the Supreme Court declined to review the case. So he said, but maybe if we do get a good case, we should go back and revisit Quill. Now, it's important to note that no other justice joined him in this concurrence. But we do have at least one justice who says, I want to hear a case to overturn Quill. Now, he didn't say overturn, but he certainly suggested that's what he wanted to do. The state of South Dakota decided to take him up on that offer. And what we have this week is just South Dakota's gotten to the point where they can now at least ask the court to do that. South Dakota passed SB 106 2 years ago. And it tells us up front, it's going to violate Quill's physical presence test. It simply says selling into South Dakota is sufficient to require you. If you sell to a South Dakota resident, that in and of itself should be sufficient to require you to collect South Dakota sales tax. Now, the law does provide that you don't have to do that if you don't sell over $100,000 and have 200 or more separate transactions. So they did put that in there to, you know, kind of keep the small business groups, or at least smaller business groups, quiet about this one. But they enacted one strictly like that. It had an interesting clause in it too. It said if it was challenged that the court had a right to have a motion for summary judgment stating that effectively, you know, this thing should be thrown out based on constitutional issues. And if that was filed, then it would be treated as an injunction barring. In essence, just really asking that question would be an injunction barring the state from collecting the tax. That was done that way. So after this passed and took effect, the state of South Dakota sued three major retailers. And obviously, they raised the defense, which means that, okay, we're not going to enforce it on anybody right now, but we do now have standing to move forward, and it's going to Supreme Court. The district court in South Dakota ruled that it's unconstitutional. It said, you know, we can't overturn Quill. South Dakota then appealed to the South Dakota Supreme Court. And this week, the South Dakota Supreme Court came down with their decision. And again, the issue in this one was that because of that Justice Kennedy decision, remember, that what they really want is to go to Supreme Court. So the South Dakota Supreme Court said, sorry, state of South Dakota, you lose. You know, it's unconstitutional, which, as upside down as it might seem, that's really the answer South Dakota wanted, because now they can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Had the other side won, what's kind of interesting is they would have had to decide, do we want to really risk a overturning Quill, or do we want to just say, okay, we'll pay South Dakota tax, we're not going to worry about any other state, you know, because then it'd be a little more difficult whether they would have appealed. But now South Dakota's announced by the middle of next month, they will file the appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. The key issue to watch right now is, does the Supreme Court take up South Dakota on this issue? And again, if they do, and if they decide to overturn Quill, then basically every state would seem likely to have a right to simply say, if you sell to our residents, you've got to collect our sales tax. The state of Massachusetts did it a little differently. In Massachusetts, we have a regulation issued, Regulation 830 CMR 64H-1-7, issued on September the 22nd. And of course, that's coming up, right? We got a couple of days till that comes into effect. It's effective that date. The regulation is aimed at internet sellers. And what it does is it says, okay, we accept physical nexus is required, but we think every internet seller basically has physical nexus. Well, why? Well, they're saying, you know, you're probably using in-state computers. You might think, well, okay. You know, A, you might be, because maybe the hosting service has a computer in Massachusetts, but it's possible they don't. But you know what you probably are doing? You're probably putting cookies on your site is probably putting cookies on the computer of the buyers in South Dakota, enabling those people to basically, you know, complete your sale, because you can't complete a sale. The way web browsers work, there's really no way to link the various calls back to the server without using cookies very easily. So the cookies there allowing the sale to be completed, and it's running on a computer in Massachusetts, or the cookie sits there because when they come back, you want to be able to log them right back in, right, and get to their account. Well, it's sitting there enabling that. So you're running on computers in Massachusetts, and yes, they're pushing that far. Of course, they have other ways you could be in trouble. You know, you might contract with FedEx to deliver your package, FedEx or UPS, to deliver your package to that Massachusetts resident. You know, because the customer called, you sell widgets. You're going to pack the widget up in a box. You're going to go to UPS, say, please deliver this to this guy in Boston. And UPS, acting on your request, is going to have a person deliver that to the office in Boston, driving on trucks, etc. You're basically using those trucks to get your widget delivered. Hey, there's Nexus. And maybe the other way is maybe, okay, you don't have anything of that, but you have a contract with, let's say, Amazon. You have an affiliate relationship. So customers go to Amazon and they use Amazon to place the sale. You may fulfill the payment. You know, you may actually ship the product to the customer, but you're using Amazon or eBay to get the customer. Amazon and eBay have Nexus in Massachusetts. We get to all those things. And because of that, and by the way, Amazon could have Nexus in Massachusetts because some of the affiliates they work with are based in Massachusetts. So it kind of becomes kind of a whipsaw event. Amazon ends up with Nexus because they have affiliates in Massachusetts. And then now you're using Amazon, which has Nexus in Massachusetts. So now suddenly you have Nexus in Massachusetts, or using eBay, all the above. In any event, let's be honest. If you read what's in our materials this week, we have all these theories written up, what's in the reg. They're probably right that if you sell over the internet, there is no way to avoid having Nexus, you know, no way to avoid physical presence. You might not have to collect, but you can't avoid physical presence. Again, to get rid of the small business complaints, they're five times more generous than South Dakota in terms of sales volume, but they decide you can have a lot fewer transactions. So you have to have sales of more than $500,000 into Massachusetts, but you only need more than 100, not 200 transactions. Depending upon the nature of your business, that may be better or worse than the South Dakota option. But if you do, you've got to collect the tax. And by the way, not much time to do it. Now, if you otherwise have to collect tax in Massachusetts, the fact that you sold less than $500,000, that's not going to save you. This only applies to people who don't fall under any other reason for having to collect sales tax in Massachusetts. It is officially effective September 22nd. Collection starts October 1st. The $500,000 for the period from October 1st to the end of December is going to look back from basically October 1st of 2016 October 1st, 2016 to September 30th of 2017. And if you go over the $500,000 in that period, then starting the 1st of October, you've got to collect the sales tax in Massachusetts and send the payment to the monthly. When we get to January 1st of 2018, we're going to go to a calendar year test. Okay. So this is another approach around Quill. Now, again, if South Dakota were to win in the Supreme Court, then Massachusetts law is automatically okay, it would appear, unless it violates Massachusetts Constitution. But if South Dakota loses, then there's still the question of, well, is this enough physical presence? So we've got three different attacks we've looked at here recently. The turn in your customers, which, by the way, has cleared at the Court of Appeals level, and the Supreme Court refused to hear that case. We've got the head-on challenge, which is the South Dakota test, or Massachusetts having a very, very broad view of minimal physical presence and then using an economic nexus test to just say, well, you sell more than this and you got to basically collect. Make sure your clients are aware that, you know, the states are getting very aggressive in this area, and it doesn't matter. Remember, this is one, sometimes you get blinders on, especially if you're in a small firm. We tend to get blinders on. Let's say, like here in Phoenix, you know, Phoenix is pretty far away from every border. So, you know, every border. So we don't really deal with a lot of, you know, situations where we're regularly selling or we have a lot of stuff going over the border. So we often think of ourselves as isolated. But even in that case, we have clients now, especially with the internet, who are able to sell into other states. And it means I can't just worry about what Arizona says. I've got to worry about every other state taxing agency in the U.S. So that means every other state, every territory of the U.S., and the District of Columbia. Let's throw them all in there. So I have to worry about the rules in all of those. Keep your eyes on this. This could get very messy very quickly. Right now, it does have these economic limits to protect small businesses. I'm a little concerned that if the Supreme Court simply wipes out Quill, or if any of these stand up, there's little reason to see why they have to stop at $500,000 or $100,000 or in Washington, just $10,000. before requiring compliance. So we could see this go down to zero. And basically any sales could trigger it if a state wanted to try that. So you just got to kind of be careful here. Finally, we have a brand new case this week. The IRS, we have the first case that we look at portability. This is, it takes a while for things in the law to finally make its way to court. And this is our first case on portability. This is the estate of Minnie Lynn Sauer versus Commissioner, 149 TC number 11. The opinion was issued on September 11th of 2017. Okay. This particular case deals with a case of the second spouse to die after the first spouse had elected the first spouse's estate had made the portability election. Minnie's husband died basically in 2012. Okay. He dies in 2012. He left Minnie as a surviving spouse. The Frank's estate timely filed a 706, had no liability, but there was a problem on the return. The Form 706 computation on the front showed no taxable gifts having been made, but it included over $940,000 of taxable gifts on the worksheet provided to calculate taxable gifts. So it basically disclosed backdoor that there were all these gifts, but they didn't bring it forward to the front when they computed the deceased spouse unused exclusion, that DSUE number we talk about. So the 706, had an issue, right? Now, despite that, it went into the IRS. There's no tax due. The IRS eventually issued a closing letter on this, issued a letter, we should say. We call it a closing letter. But they issued a letter stating that they accepted the return as filed. Okay. Now, Minnie then dies the following year. In 2013, Minnie dies. Now, Frank's estate had claimed an unused exclusion of over $1,250,000. Minnie dies, of course, now saying, she passes. We add that $1,250,000 to her standard exclusion amount, and then we compute her estate tax. Now, Minnie still had, some taxable estate, but not very much. The IRS gets Minnie's return. The IRS opens an exam on Minnie's return, and that's not surprising, right? Here we have a taxable estate. The IRS likes to look at that. The first estate was pretty clear there wouldn't be any tax to be received. So even though they'd already issued in the IRS initial letter 627, which they call a state closing document that they return had been accepted as filed, when they got the return, they pulled Frank 706, and the agent, seeing that disclosure of those gifts, adjusted the DSUE amount, computed, by the way, they made the same error on Minnie 706, so they also corrected Minnie 706 for her lifetime gifts, and the estate's not disputing that, but they also changed Frank's and dramatically reduced his deceased spouse's unused exclusion amount. So she got far less of that, and that caused a lot of tax to be due. Minnie's estate said, you can't change that. They said, obviously, that's wrong. You can't change it. Well, the first thing they said was, look, we got a closing letter. That's a closed return. You can't examine it. The tax court said, wait a second here. We have an issue here. Yes, portability was elected on the husband's return. Here's our problem, though. The only tax is going to be on the wife's return. We know about that, okay? And it's going to be done on the 706. They said in IRC section 2010 C5B, added to the code when portability came in, specifically the law states that notwithstanding any period of limitations against that first filed return, there's an absolute right of the IRS to examine that return and adjust the DSUE amount potentially down to zero at the death of the second spouse. Okay, we specifically have that authority. That authority is restated in what was temporary regulation 20-2010-2D. Today, virtually identical language is in the final regulation that basically gives the IRS the authority to examine the return. And the court said, even if the Congress hadn't done that, Section 7602 grants the IRS broad rights to review anything that might be relevant to the current tax on the return. And they said clearly this was relevant. What the proper DSUE was relevant in computing the tax due on Minnie's estate. But the estate said, but wait a minute, we've got that closing letter. The tax court said, that's not a closing agreement. They said, generally, a closing agreement must be on Form 866 or Form 906 per the regulations. Now, they recognized in the Treaty Pines Investments Partnership versus Commissioner case in 1992, the Fifth Circuit had allowed a closing agreement to be done not using one of those forms. But they said there was a clear negotiation among the parties about a specific dispute. They said, in this case, there was no negotiations. The IRS just took the return and they accepted Frank's return. They also said, here's another problem. We're not assessing a single dollar of tax on Frank's return. We're not going after Frank's return and collecting tax. We're after Minnie's return. And because of that, we have the right to do it. Well, the estate said, yeah, but there's this other provision. 7605B says that basically the IRS doesn't have a right to look at the books and records more than once for a taxpayer in an exam. The court said, fine, here's the problem though. That only applies to the taxpayer who was examined. That was the estate of Frank Sauer. And only the estate of Frank Sauer could raise that objection. They said, and this is the estate of Minnie Sauer. They said, number two, they didn't go look at the records again. They just looked at 706 that was filed. So they didn't need to go back and look again. They just took the data you already gave them. So there's no evidence they even requested anything. So there's no way 7605 could cause this to be broken. Now they said, well, they're saying, but this goes against the whole purpose Congress had in enacting portability. And they tried to reference to various congressional intent and congressional reports. And the court said, if the actual literal language of the law, they put a provision in that says the IRS can go look at that old return. If the literal language of the law says something unambiguously, which this does, it doesn't matter if you can find a committee report that says they intended the opposite. Congress, the courts have to follow the law as written, unless there is ambiguity. Congressional intent is only relevant if we have an ambiguous provision. This provision is not at all ambiguous. This provision says Congress said, go examine it. And that's exactly what they did. So the court found the IRS had acted appropriately. The key thing to remember is that 706 from the first deceased spouse, it's not as if the surviving spouse can live 3 years, the problem goes away as the values on that first estate. In fact, if the surviving spouse lives 20 years, we need to be able to defend that 20-year-old 706 to defend that DSUE. Important to remember that, you know, that 3-year statute, many people and a lot of clients and even some professionals get confused about what that statute means. That statute does not stop them from looking at that return. They just can't assess tax against that return. Secondly, that quote closing document is not a closing letter. You know, it's not a closing agreement. I shouldn't say letter, but agreement. It's not a closing agreement. They still can go after that return. They are not barred as they are with a true closing agreement, which is a contract with the taxpayer. So make sure your clients and your executors and somebody preserves all that data, because at the death of the surviving spouse, that's the point at which the IRS is almost certainly going to be examining the 706 for the first spouse to die. If in fact it's clear at the first spouse to die, there's no way there could be tax then because everything went to the survivor. So we have our first case. You know, be sure you understand these rules and be sure your clients understand the records they're going to have to keep. As we say and always say, be sure to check out what your state CPA society has for offerings. Go ahead and check that. They're the reason why we can do this on a weekly basis. So, it's important to go in, take a look. They offer a number of very useful courses. You can go and talk with people who are practicing in the field. That's the other nice thing about going to these live courses. You can actually talk to somebody live. You can also get to interact with other people in your area that have this. You can learn a lot just from the other participants in the course. There's lots of neat conversations. So be sure to go check out your state society of CPAs and check out what their offerings are coming up here as we get past. I know you're all, many of you are thinking, I'm in the middle of filing right now. I can't think of this. Give yourself 5 minutes, 10 minutes, go look at what your society has. Get ready for those offerings from October 15th to December 15th, because that's the time most of you are looking. So take a look at what's coming up. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September 18th. Remember that we post updates throughout the week at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We also have on that site a PDF file that will have all the articles describing several developments I talked about this week and links to the supporting documents where they're available. You know, so you can get the real documents, RRS notices, etc. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. I post there, as I post things here, it'll be at edzollers. So as things go to the website, we'll tell you about that when I post the actual video and audio each week. That also goes to Twitter, so you can get all of that from that location. Again, we look forward to this next week. Hey, this is your down week, right? There's not a deadline this week. That comes up the following week. We're rushing to the next deadline. So this is your easy week. So after your easy week this week, we'll take a look next week at what's happened and try to get you ready for your next filing deadline, which will be the one coming up for your estates and trusts. Until then, take care, and we'll see you next week.